The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On January 20th and 21st, the National Mall in Washington, D.C. was packed for Donald Trump's inauguration on Friday and the March for Women's Lives on Saturday. Trump and his press secretary asserted that they got the largest crowd ever to witness an inauguration. PolitiFact graded that as a pants-on-fire distortion of the truth. Still, despite official estimates, off-the-cuff guesses, and even aerial photos that look hard to dispute, determining the actual numbers of those crowds is no easy feat. How do you measure a giant shifting mass of thousands and thousands of bodies? One nonpartisan company that provides crowd estimates is Digital Design and Imaging Service Incorporated. Reporter Sean Kapton dug into their work and the complicated science of crowd estimates for Fast Company. Sean, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So DDIS, I'm going to use that for stand in for Digital Design and Imaging Service Incorporated, hired by two media organizations to provide crowd counts for the Women's March on January 21st, pretty confident of their count of 440,000 people at the DC March anyway, but said they could not be as confident measuring crowds during the inauguration. Now, why can they not? It's the same space, same weekend.
It was a bad day, really, for measuring both events, but especially for the inauguration. There was heavy cloud cover, which made satellite imagery impossible. That was used pretty effectively with President Obama's inaugurations. Also, the inauguration is essentially a no-fly zone, so flying a drone or, as DIS does, a balloon over the area wouldn't have been permitted. So there's really no way to get an aerial view of the inauguration.
So they use satellites, they use drones. Tell us more about their methodology. How do they actually measure crowds?
Yeah, DDIS relies mainly on balloons because they can fly at about 600 feet or so, which gives them pretty high resolution photos of the crowd. They do a lot of aerial surveillance work in different areas, but in terms of crowd counting, their first major project was Glenn Beck's Rally for Sanity in 2010. In which they did a pretty accurate crowd count for CBS News that came in way below what the organizers had estimated. Estimates, which I think were pretty back of the envelope for the organizers, were between 300 and 650,000 people. DDIS came out with 80,000. And pretty much everyone who's anyone in the crowd measurement and science world was 100% behind DDIS's methodology. They said it was very sound.
So companies do use this aerial imagery to determine a crowd size. What happens? How do they account for tree cover or buildings or shadows or other visual obstacles?
Yeah, one thing that's important to do a good crowd count is you have to have scouted the area and understand it well ahead of time. So you have a sense, for example, of how much obstruction there is in certain areas. The counting is done by dividing an area into grids. And so you can get a sense of grids that have trees, may have fewer people or they may have more people. Say it's a sunny day, for example, you can assume certain kinds of behavior of people depending on the weather, depending on the topography. So you kind of have a sense ahead of time how much each area can hold. And then there's also some science around how big a crowd can be before basically it becomes untenable because people start crowding so tightly that it becomes uncomfortable and even dangerous. So you kind of have an idea of what areas of a segment, how many people they can hold overall, and how many they're likely to hold, given how long people are there and what people can tolerate, essentially.
There were some reports I saw from the Women's March that people couldn't actually move around, or they didn't have any place really to go. Was it nearing that danger threshold?
There are various levels of discomfort. It's something called the Fruin scale of service, but there are different levels. There are a point at which basically you're pretty cozy with people, but you're probably not at a point where you're going to get freaked out by it. I'm guessing is they did not go beyond that point because I didn't hear about any incidents of any types of injuries or any type of panic happening. Because at a certain level, you get to a point where if someone moves or panics, you could have something like a stampede, which is a constant concern, say at the Hajj in Saudi Arabia, for example, and they've actually been employing some crowd science around that to try to head off situations where you could have a stampede issue. Clearly, we didn't get anywhere close to that at the Women's March.
What is the margin of error for this kind of count? Is there any way of corroborating the numbers and verifying them?
There, in the Women's March, it was fortunate that two bodies had actually done counts. The other one had been Manchester University in the UK. They used a slightly different count. It was based a lot on this level of service, this Fruin scale, of understanding how many people could logically fit in an area. They did also, towards the end of their work, correspond with DDIS, basically sort of check each other's methodology. Manchester came up with 470,000, which is really close. And when I spoke with Kurt Westergaard, who's the president of DDIS, he said, you know, that's within 10%. He said that made him feel very confident. So you can't say down to the person. In an event this big, you can't even say down to the 1,000 people. But if you're getting within 10% of something, you've got a good sense of the magnitude of an event. And that's really the best you can hope for.
There are vested organizations who also came up with their own crowd estimates, as we know. You know, Donald Trump said he had this much of a crowd. The Women's March organizer said X amount for both the inauguration and the Women's March. So how did they come by their numbers?
Donald Trump, from what I've heard, basically came by what it looked like to him. He's not a crowd scientist, for example. Also, the perspective, and I used to live in D.C. I've seen the perspective from the steps of the Capitol, you know, where he was speaking from. You can only see so far. And the area right in front of the Capitol is absolutely packed. And that's basically pretty much all you see when you're there. So he saw, you know, a sea of people that looked like it extended onto the horizon, but he was not seeing most of the area. I wouldn't put really any stock in what he could see. Even if you were an expert, he just wouldn't see it very well. The Women's March, they did a lot of organizing on Facebook, for example, also on some other event-based sites like Eventbrite, for example. So they were making estimates largely by what they had in terms of people who had said they were going to go and then after the event confirmed that they had gone. Their estimates were a little optimistic in some places. For example, in London, they probably were pretty far over what would have been practical. I spoke with researchers there. They were figuring maybe around 50, 60,000 people. London said 100,000. In Austin, based on Facebook, they estimated 38,000. And both the Austin police and Manchester came up with 50,000. So in some cases, they seem to have been pretty close. In other cases, they might have been a little optimistic or even very optimistic. And again, you know, just like Donald Trump, there's a potential to, one, exaggerate maybe for political reasons, and two, just because they're not experts and they don't really know how to do it.
My guest is Sean Kapton. He researched and wrote for Fast Company about measuring crowds or crowd science, when size really does matter in the case of measuring crowds. You mentioned Austin for the Women's March. Much of what I saw was actually March, whereas in D.C. and other places, it looked a little bit more static. Tell me about the science of counting a moving target rather than a static event.
Yeah, things get much more difficult when you're trying to count a moving target. The D.C. one was obviously one good example. People had congregated on the National Mall for a rally, and then they marched mainly up Pennsylvania Avenue, but also up some other streets, like 15th Street, to get near the White House. So then the question is, what part of it has to be, you know, when do you look at a crowd? Do you look at it as it's amassing? Do you look at it at its sort of peak before it starts marching? Do you look at the march? Do you look at both the beginning point and the end point and try to get some photos in between? So you get a lot more margin for error. An example in D.C., what they did was they basically picked the point at which the march was filling up Pennsylvania Avenue pretty well on its way to the White House, and they had a good view over both the mall and Pennsylvania Avenue and most of the other streets as well. So they could pretty much see, you know, more or less everyone. And there's some science around understanding if you can't see a certain region, for example, but you have a sense of how many people it can hold, you know, you can make a guess for who's in those areas you can't see. It's nowhere near as exact when people are moving.
So given the cloud cover, especially on Inauguration Day, will we ever really know the exact number size of the inauguration crowd?
Nowhere near. There are some other ways to get a sense of magnitude. Keith Still, who's a professor of crowd science at Manchester, was hired by the New York Times to do just to look at photos of the Obama inauguration and the Trump inauguration. And he made a rough estimate, you know, with some science and some guesstimate, that the crowd at the Trump inauguration was about a third as large. And we have figures for the Obama inauguration, although they vary a lot as well. So we at least know it was, based on his assessment, it was a lot smaller. But anything beyond that, you really can't say for the Trump inauguration.
Well, just looking at the photos, that seems pretty clear.
It does seem pretty clear. I mean, there's always a question of when were the photos taken? You know, was it, you know, 45 minutes before the inauguration, the oath of office starts? How many more people would trickle in, you know, in time for that? Were people running late? So there's some dispute about when the photo was taken, but pretty much every photo at any time, you know, shows a big discrepancy. Clearly the Trump inauguration looks smaller by any measure. There's also measures of how many people took public transit, and it was considerably larger for both the Obama inaugurations and for the Women's March the following day.
It still sounds pretty imprecise. I mean, it sounds like weather forecasting. Any hope that we will see advances in crowd counting science by inauguration 2021?
There could be. I spoke with researchers at the University of Central Florida, and they're using more image recognition and algorithmic counting of crowds. They can do some interesting things. In crowd counting, currently, you have to, at least to an extent, count heads. Now, not in every single part of the image, because obviously you'd go insane trying to do that. You know, you divide the area into grids, and you get a sense, you know, so many grids X, Y, and Z can hold about the same number of people. So if you count X, you have a sense of Y and Z. But there's obviously limitations to that, and especially if you're doing it by satellite, which in some cases, like the inauguration, is really your only way to get an overhead view. You know, you're getting down to the point where, you know, an individual head might be one pixel, and that's just too low a resolution. But with some image recognition and study algorithms, you can basically start counting things that a person can't count. And part of it is, for example, you train the AI on blurry images, but you know how many people are there. You know, you have this what they call a ground truth, and you see how close the algorithm comes to that, and you keep training it until basically even when you can't make it out visually as a person, you're getting from whatever points of light and dark, and even sort of frequency, you know, of light and dark and color, you can judge from that how many people it is. So basically, a computer can recognize really subtle signs that a human can't recognize. So there's hope that it can become more accurate and also a lot faster. You know, they can do it maybe in a half hour, whereas today's methods can take days.
Sean Kaptan, contributor to Fast Company, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Our new Civics 101 podcast launched on Inauguration Day with the goal of answering your questions about how our democracy works. All that stuff you should have learned in school or may have forgotten or maybe slept through. Today's lesson covers the notice and comment rulemaking procedure, or more commonly known as the comment period. The Trump administration has made clear that it will eliminate or reverse a number of Obama's policies. But before it does, some will be submitted to the public for comment. Maybe you've heard of the comment period, but do you know what it means or what exactly happens during that time? And does it ever actually sway decisions? Jody Freeman is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and I asked her to lay out the basic framework of the comment period.
So this is the process that federal agencies use when they issue rules, which are also called regulations. And when they put out a new rule, they have to propose it and wait for a period for public comment to come in. They take that comment. Sometimes it's 30 days, 60 days, or sometimes longer, when the opportunity is there for anybody to actually comment on that proposed rule. Then the agency takes all of that input under consideration and usually revises the rule accordingly and then issues a final rule in the end.
So when people say, or advocates say, call your senator, send a letter, send something to the president, is that what they mean? This is the comment period?
No, it's not quite like that. It's really more formal than that. Let's say it's the Environmental Protection Agency issuing an environmental regulation. There's actually what's called a docket, which is really just a file system for managing that rulemaking process. And you have to submit the comments to the agency through a process. Actually, you don't even have to do it anymore physically. You can do it online through email rulemaking.
And you, meaning any member of the public, could do that?
Anybody can do it.
So it's a way of kind of registering your opinion outside of voting.
Exactly. And it's not just organized groups that do it. Of course, business groups are very sophisticated at this, and they hire teams of lawyers to file these comments to represent their interests. And there are also advocacy groups, public health groups, citizen groups, and labor, organized labor. Every group you can imagine is involved in filing comments along with business. But also individual citizens can do it, too.
Okay. Does anyone really pay attention? Like, if, you know, something is proposed and there are 17 comments pro and 19 con, does that mean the cons have it?
No, it's not really like a vote. They're really meant to be substantive comments on what the agency is suggesting it wants to do. And in fact, there can be literally hundreds of thousands of comments that come into an agency on some of the most controversial rules, like air pollution rules, let's say. They attract an awful lot of comments. And many of them are incredibly detailed, really sophisticated, from experts on the particular topic, and especially from business interests and advocacy groups that have a lot to say about those rules.
How do we file a comment?
Well, you just have to go to the agency website, and you can look at that agency's proposed rules, and you can see the process for filing comments. Often you can do it online, e-commenting, and so it's actually a pretty easy process.
Can these comments actually affect the final ruling or change a ruling?
Absolutely. In fact, by law, there's a specific law that requires these agencies to consider these comments and to respond to the most important points that those comments make. So the agency can't just ignore them. They actually have to come out with a document after the comment period that explains all of the major points that were made in the comments and then also explains what the agency has done about them. And the reason we know this is actually important and legally binding on the agency, and the reason we know they take it seriously, is that if that rule is ever challenged in court, the court will look at the agency's reasoning and will look at the statement that the agency has made in response to the comments and will evaluate whether the agency has been arbitrary or has been rational in how it has issued this rule.
So what is the process for the rules after the public comments have been made?
So after the comments, the agencies have to take some time and digest them, and then they have to issue what's called a concise statement of basis and purpose. And all that means is they have to issue a written rationale, a written explanation of why their rule has come out the way it's come out and how it responds to the most cogent, important comments that have been made. And so it's really a written document that justifies the agency's decision, and that's what goes into the record to support the rule. And if it ever gets legally challenged, that's really the agency's defense of its rulemaking.
Can you give us a real-world example of how comment periods or comments have affected a rule?
Well, I'll give you an example, sure. So in a classic case about the regulation of sugared foods and sugared milks being subsidized by the federal government, whether the federal government should put certain foods into a nutrition program for citizens who are getting some assistance with food packages, the government took comment on what foods belong in that subsidized nutrition package. And a lot of comments came in saying, you know, sugared cereals are really bad for kids, and sugared flavored milks are really bad for kids, and you shouldn't subsidize these when you're trying to boost the nutrition of women and children. And the agency responsible for this took a look at it and said, you're right, we shouldn't really subsidize foods that are bad for you. We're going to remove chocolate milk from our food package. And this created a huge uproar because the chocolate milk industry went bananas and were very upset, and it produced a lawsuit. But it just shows you how a community can comment on a rulemaking and make a difference in the final result.
So you're talking about government agency rules. But, for example, we're talking to you at the beginning of the Trump administration. Donald Trump has made clear that he will eliminate or reverse a number of Obama administration policies on day one. Now, since this means changing government rules, does this open up a comment period?
Yes. So when you want to rescind a rule, revoke a rule, you have to go through the exact same process. You can't just wipe it off the books on day one. The president would have to ask his agency, let's say in this case the Environmental Protection Agency, since we've been working with that example, and that agency would have to go through the same notice and comment process for actually rescinding a rule and replacing it with something different. So again, this isn't just with a stroke of a pen that you can do this. A president can announce he's going to do something, but he has to go through the responsible federal agency.
So, Jody, what do you think is the most crucial takeaway for our listeners for our civics lesson on comment periods?
I think the most important thing to know is there's actually a legal process for how government agencies issue binding legal rules that affect the public. They don't do things arbitrarily. They don't do things in a day or two. They have to take the time to submit them to the public for comment and then to consider those comments. So nothing happens at the stroke of a pen. It's a very considered, careful process, and it's governed by a whole set of laws that try to hold those agencies to account. And on top of that, there is judicial review, meaning those rules can be challenged in court, and they have to be defended by the agency, too. So there are lots of checks and balances on what agencies can do.
Jody Freeman, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Harvard Law Professor Jody Freeman giving us a primer on the comment period for Episode 3 of Civics 101. You won't miss a single Civics 101 class when you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play by searching for Civics 101. It's the class that you can actually skip and then listen to later when you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Just search Civics 101. And we would love to hear from you. If there's something you'd like us to cover, visit Civics101podcast.org and submit your question. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, we invite you to share stories and segments with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of our archives to listen to. You can post them on social media or email them to friends. And let us know what you are hearing from your circle of friends and colleagues and sources. What are you curious about? What are you finding interesting? Or what is scratching at your sense of wonder? We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Please keep sharing them and join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.